therapy, it ain't helping much. Feel like I'm losing touch, feel like a ball I'm crushed. They say the past is the past, but it keeps showing up.
Welcome to Changing the Narrative.
The media likes to tell our stories for us, but we decided to change the narrative by telling our own stories.
In this episode of Changing the Narrative,
Paul Terry sits down with Social Justice Learning Institute advocates Derek Steele and David Turner.
Dominique Williams, Tashad Rutherford.
At the school that I go to, Loyola Marymount University, in these predominantly white communities, and like really don't understand culturally any of your experience, I think the way that you communicate with others, especially in like certain classes where topics are more controversial, a lot of those conversations would be like so difficult because it's something that I'm passionate about, but at the same time, that kind of turns into like the angry black woman narrative very quickly, and people are totally fine with taking that stereotype and running with it. It's like taking parts of yourself apart, hiding parts of yourself, or like picking and choosing what you think can best be presented to others in a way that doesn't seem, I guess, like intimidating or off-putting, kind of like shaping yourself, and you kind of just like have to build another person that's like kind of you with the most palatable parts of you put together and like everything else like taken away. It has a toll on an individual when you're doing that. Now I've just realized that like I can do whatever I want.
My granny was took from me due to cancer. I had my whole team, my family, my brothers. I had them to lean on. I opened up to them and they just took me in more. They made sure I was straight every day. The whole thing is like, we gotta be a family. You don't know what a person is going through. And some people not willing to be like me and open up. Just as a race, I know we should do the same, pick each other up, because we all been through something. Even though we cope different, we all go through something. We all got a struggle of our own. If it wasn't for them dudes, if it wasn't for me playing football, I was ready to quit. I was ready to just quit it all. I died when she died, but they didn't let me, and I didn't let myself. And it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go. And it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no.
Hi, my name is Paul Terry. This is my segment, Wanting to Live. Growing up as a black male in the inner city was very rough, very hard. The lack of resources was overwhelming. I was dealing with severe depression, became antisocial, was shut in, wasn't progressing towards anything. But I had those people around me to help me out of what I was going through. So in turn of coming around young black males in the inner city, seeing that they were going through the same thing I was going through, really wanted me to help them. But in understanding every situation, I turned to a few mentors to help me really get what the meaning of living was. In doing this segment, I needed to research. And the research I found was very overwhelming. As per the Office of the U.S. Surgeon General, 25% of African American youth exposed to violence have proven to be at a high risk for PTSD. Of 34 million people who identify as African American, 22% live in poverty. These individuals are particularly at risk for mental health illness due to an overrepresentation in the homeless population. I find this very disturbing. I needed some help to understand how these statistics came to be. So I sat down to interview Derek Steele and David Turner, two big advocates in health and educational equity for minority communities. I needed to get a full understanding of what really causes these problems.
So my name is David Turner. I'm currently the Programs Manager for Educational Equity at the Social Justice Learning Institute. 27 years old, from Inglewood, California. It's my job primarily to oversee our education program, so, you know, to make sure that things are running smoothly, to build new partnerships, as well as to direct our youth policy efforts. I'm also a doctoral candidate in the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley.
So my name is Derek Steele. I am currently the Health Equity Programs Director at the Social Justice Learning Institute. I'm originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, born and raised, but I've lived here in Inglewood for the last 10 plus years. It's been an amazing experience being here, but I've learned so much about what folks go through on a day-to-day basis. And through the work, I guess, over the last 8 years that we've been doing, we've been able to make impact on a lot of lives. And I think it's really tremendous, you know, what we've been able to do and the impact we've been able to make, teaming up with folks like you, my man Dave, and so many others here at the Social Justice Learning Institute. So, yeah, we out here.
Okay, so I brought you guys in here today to speak on the mental health aspect about living in a community of color, specifically Black community. We have a lot of misconceptions about the way we live, how we're perceived. So I just want to get your perspective on what about living in a Black community kind of takes a toll on your mental health, and what can you do to improve your individual mental health living in a Black community?
Well, I think the tenets of Sankofa is the first thing that comes to mind, right? We start talking about mental health and the reasons why the thoughts that are out there, especially in communities of color, are the way they are. There's a lot of trauma that goes with that. And so when you start thinking about, well, what is that trauma? It goes deep, man. There's a rich, rich history that never really gets talked about, mainly because we're look to be so resilient, and we have been so resilient over the years, and we're always looking forward. But like I said, the reason why I started with Sankofa, because you got to know where you come from to know where you're going and what you need to be doing today in order to get to where you're going. So I'm excited to actually sit here with my man Dave to actually hear his point of view from the standpoint, and I wanted to start it from there, from that standpoint, be like, yo, bro, like, drop the science on, drop the history on how we got here in the first place. We start thinking about trauma and communities of color. I'm in my mind, I'm thinking Black community, but there's more than just ours that deal with the same thing when you say communities of color. Mm. So let me get out of the way.
That's real. So I'm an education scholar, right? So I tie and link most things that I do back to education and learning, right? So what I kind of want to start with is how, I want to start off with our condition here, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Black communities in particular, but communities of color in general, are, you know, byproducts of what we call settler colonialism, right? Which is how European folks came to the United States to settle the land and take the land from indigenous folks and have, you know, Black slaves or enslaved Africans, right, be the ones to work the land, right? So you don't just do that by, you know, like, that doesn't just happen only because you have guns, right? People have to opt in, right? Mm. But that opt in isn't necessarily like a choice. It's forced on you, right? And it's forced on you through learning, right? It's forced on you through education systems, right? So one of the ways in which we learned on how to obey, or one of the ways we learned how to, you know, be in the system is through trauma and pain, right? So when you have a child and the child was murdered at birth, right, by slave owners, right? Or when people's limbs are tied to horses and the horses are forced to run in different directions so that way the human body is physically tied apart, right, or pushed apart. So again, right, like this trauma, right, that came from enslavement, right, you know, in 1865, there weren't psychologists hanging outside of plantations to ask Black folks, you know, like, how are you doing? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, and to compound that, right, the conditions, even though they changed, the oppression never stopped.
Facts.
Right? So because that oppression never stopped, right, like, we were, you know, we were sort of, I think the proper term is the ways in which we were able to be healthy was enclosed and pushed to the side, right? Like, we weren't allowed to be healthy, right? Even when we tried to be, there were systems in place to ensure that we weren't, right? So to give you an example of this, right? Like, there's a lot of discourse and talk that, you know, black people don't trust medicine, or black people don't trust, you know, psychologists. That's accurate. And they have every right not to, right? When we talk about the Tuskegee syphilis experiments.
Absolutely.
Right, you know, and how black people were experimented upon. And this mm-hmm. wasn't hundreds of years ago, right? There are people's grandparents, right, or even parents who were a part of these, right? So, again, you know, like, I think when we talk about mental health in the black community, right, like, there are very real systems in place mm-hmm. that made what we went through, right, and what we continue to go through a challenge, right? So when we start talking about addressing trauma, right, we got to start there.
And I think to that point, just to add on to that, you know, you fast forward through all the trauma that we've experienced, like I said, there were no psychologists out there asking those questions and trying to figure that out. So mental health and ways to deal with mental health was never really a part of the experience, right? And so as we have gone through, what we have done in that place is to find ways to be resilient and to continue to move forward and to press forward. Church has become a major part of that, and, like, you know, being able to talk to your pastor or to go to church every Sunday and to hear what the word is saying, you know, the word of God, and using that to help inform what you're doing. You know, like, there's been ways that or self-medication has been historically a part of that process as well. Like, we've been able to figure out ways to be resilient, to keep pressing forward in order to change the social conditions around us. But even today, to this point, I think we're finally getting to the point to talk about trauma and how it has impacted us and how to unpack all those things for over years, generations that have not been unpacked at all, stories that had not been told, in order to be able to figure out how we move forward. And so there's beginning to be some language around this that we're beginning to talk to our parents, our grandparents about, even talk to each other about determining what the social determinants of health are that keep us in the conditions that we have in our communities, how to transform those things. Like, those conversations are happening now.
Yeah, and to speak on the psychological thing, psychiatrists and psychologists now are trying to be more involved in minority communities. But the thing is, you have a lot of microaggressions and a lot of disconnect and a lot of cultural unawareness uh-huh. to where when you have psychologists trying to incite therapy upon communities of color, there is no common ground. So you don't have a connection with your patient. And I feel like that's also a thing to where when we come into education, you need to educate more culturally aware, more minorities to fill those positions to be able to treat the community. So, that's from my perspective. Another question I have is, what practices can we do amongst each other to kind of lift one another up in our communities right now? To start off with?
I'll jump into that. I'm not sure, like, I think this is something, right, that we can sort of talk about later, but there's a program called the Black Barbershop Project, right? And the Black Barbershop Project specifically works with men, right, black men in particular, on mental health and trains barbers, right, you know, on how to be able to coach folks, right? Doesn't train barbers to become psychologists or therapists, because they're not, right? But if somebody's going through a stressful situation, to be able to train a barber to understand what that is, and then, right, to be able to adjust from there, right? I think Derek made a point earlier that church was, you know, was a place where black folks sought mental health help, right? You know, through spirituality, right? I think that continues to exist now. So I think if we're going to be serious about addressing it, right, like addressing it through existing or new or forming community institutions, right, is absolutely critical, you know. So if we're going to be real, right, like, it has to be community led, mm-hmm. right, and it has to be connected with, you know, the needs of what the with the needs of the community, as well as understand the community. And mm-hmm. I'll give you a brief example. while I was at UC Berkeley, right, one of the things that we were fighting for in our demands for the Black Student Union was Black psychologists, right? You know, because Black students would go through things on campus and we would try to see other psychologists there, but they wouldn't understand, right? So we're talking about racial microaggressions, right? And how somebody who's like my size, you know, I'm 6'5", 300 plus pounds, right? Like people would say, oh yeah, you're on the football team, right? Like, and I'm not. Right. Right. Like I'm actually going to be your TA next semester. Right. You know, but again, right. Like, you know, that takes a toll on you after a while. Right. So as the only presence you can see me for on this institution is something that can benefit it and not me. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, and when I talk to psychologists about that, right, they're like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's a compliment. Right. No. It's not, you know, so again, right, like, you know, I think that when you have folks who are connected to the community and understand what folks go through, right, which professors like Howard Stevenson over at the University of Pennsylvania call racialized stress, right, then I think, you know, we can have a more honest conversation about how to address mental health.
See, that's the hard part too, though, right? A lot of these institutions were not created with us in mind. Right, people Absolutely. Of color at all, let alone, you know, let alone Black folks. You know, like when we start really talking about the pecking order, we have the bottom. So they weren't thinking about us at all when they created these. So even the way that mental health or psychiatrists or the way that these things were developed, and the mindset that you have to be in order to be able to have these discussions with people of color and understanding their particular stressors or things that have gotten them to the point of where they are, like you, the questions haven't even been developed in the right way to ask for people of color of what they're dealing with, right? And then you also have to take into consideration, you know, from a historical context, if you're looking at the system of psychiatry and in its development, the way that it is taught today is years and years old, right? So there's a lot of research and work that went into developing the system as it is. Mm-hmm. So the solution isn't even as simple as, oh, well, we need to just get more Black psychiatrists. Well, no, because in order to deal with the mental health of Black people, there has to be years and years of unpacking decades and generations worth of trauma and experience that has been swept under the rug for all this time, right? So, you know, it's the conversation is being started, but we're just scratching the surface. We're not even treading water yet. Like, we just put our toe in the water of all the things that need to be done in order to create what's necessary to deal with the mental health issues that are here and that we're dealing with. And there's so many directions you can go in with it as well. And so to go back to your question, you asked the question of, like, what are some of the things we can do? Well, you know, this discussion and this conversation is a start, right? This is a part of that puzzle of really saying and being honest about, you know, where what we're doing and where we're headed. Like, it's good and it's all well and it's in the right direction, but there's so much more we need to do. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness training is another thing that we can get into to really get folks in the mindset of how to be honest about what your circumstances are in front of you, right? Because we are so resilient, we're always so forward thinking and forward looking. Sometimes dealing with the reality is something that we don't do, which is why self-medication becomes a part of things that folks of color end up getting themselves into. The reason why drug use is the way it is in our communities, right? And so mindfulness becomes very important because it gives you an opportunity to be in the moment, to really take in where you are right now, right? So, like I agree with Dave, a lot of this stuff has to be community-led. It has to be led by folks who understand what the situations are in our communities and why we are here where we are as well.
If I could touch on that point real quick. So while I was at Penn, The guy I mentioned earlier, Howard Stevenson, he had this project called PLAY, Preventing Long-Term Anger and Aggression in Youth, right? And we specifically worked with black male middle school students, right? And, you know, we would talk about mental health, we would talk about stress, and then we would do this sort of experiment where we would play basketball with them, or we would play whatever sport that the weather allowed us to play. I mean, it's Philadelphia, right? So whatever sport the weather allowed us to play, right? And we would purposefully put them through very stressful situations, right? Like, so we would, you know, play basketball with them and foul them and wouldn't let them call it, right? Or we would, you know, like call stuff on them and, you know, it, nothing happened, right? Like, and then we would do this, and then we would have other folks like on the sidelines, you know, tracking people's stress levels, right? But we had to create those questions for what those stress levels were, and then we had to check in with the young people, right? And we had to, we created a ranking system where young people would self-rank where they were, and then we would rank them where we thought that they were, right? Mm-hmm. Now, all of the research assistants are all black, right? The person who designed the study is also black, right? Like, so again, now we actually have a black population which to study, so that way we can actually generate conclusions that are rooted in black identity, right? Mm-hmm. Now, so much of psychology, right, is rooted in white middle class identity, right? Because that's only people who psychologists were studying. So when they say that somebody has a disorder, mind you, they're only operating from what is the norm for white middle class folks, right? Not for what is the norm for everyone else. So, you know, like when we have folks who are creating the language and who are, you know, creating the, and who are like helping to provide us with these tools, then we're able to, you know, then we're able to really create real interventions, right, for our people. But unless we're in the spaces to do that, right, then that's not going to happen, right? Facts. So, you know, like what happens when, you know, there's like, I mean, Howard Stevenson and at the time, Sean Harper were the only two black male professors at Penn. Or not at Penn, but in the Penn GSC at that time who were full professors, right? Like, there wasn't anybody else. It was just them two. You know? So, again.
Okay. Speaking on the black identity, this would be my last question. For me growing up, that was an issue. Not being aware of a black identity growing up and having to deal with those stresses, which are completely unknown, when you're going through junior high and high school, and coming to terms with that and being aware and staying in tune with yourself culturally made a big difference in my life, as to where not knowing about it put stress on all that. So what would you say to someone that is going through this transition on finding themselves and how and where they can look and how they can turn to like kind of starting and finding their journey at being a black individual in America?
Wow.
That's, that joint is heavy. That's a heavy question, my dude. What would I say? Well, first I'll give him a hug. If I can see that this young man, or maybe not a not necessarily a physical hug, I will probably want to because I'm a hugger, you know what I mean? I'm just that guy. But no, on the real, like really sitting down and having a chat and discussion as to where they are. I mean, that's the work we do here. Every single day. Yeah, we have our programs areas and we have our focuses and how we approach the work. But a lot of times there are these sidebar conversations that happen that are not tracked, that are not data filled, or not, you know, we're actually just touching heart to heart as to where they are and what their experiences is or experiences are. And then using my own experience to help highlight something that they may be going through to maybe set them on a course that they probably would not have been on if they didn't have the discussion, right? There's not a silver bullet answer to changing that young person's life to put them on a path to the right direction, because all of our lives and the stresses that we deal with are all different, right? However, as Dave was kind of pointing out and I kind of touched on a little bit, you know, as we continue to do this work, and as we continue to unpack these things and as we continue to track these things, we can get ourselves to a point where there is like a, what is the word I want to use? A toolkit that can be used, that parents can maybe even take on as they're raising their children. Like, you know, my wife and I, we work on this stuff all day. I was just talking to Daniel earlier about my daughter. Like, she's at an age, she's 11 years old, young, black, creative, amazing young lady, right? Who now has to deal with peer pressure, that now has to deal with the stress of being a black young lady that loves K-pop, right? And like, how does that even work? Like, there isn't something that's already set up for her to be able to follow, a blueprint to follow for stuff like that. But what I can help her do is help her understand herself enough for her to be able to walk into the world in whatever realm that she wants to be in, knowing who she truly is, right? And so that's really what it comes down to, like really starting the conversations of really unpacking who you believe you are. What is the self-identity that you see yourself in? And how do you begin to walk in the world always standing in that light and being confident and standing in that light too? Because that confidence is something that can't be taught, man. That's something that comes from within. But there are certain things that you can learn from other people to really say, you know what, I love that about me, you know, and I'm gonna go ahead and always stand firm on those types of things. And I know it's okay to stand firm on it because this is quirky about Derek, and he stands firm in that all the time. You know what I mean? So it just, there's a lot, man. It ain't easy. That ain't an easy answer, easy question to answer. But there is a lot of work that's being put towards that end.
I think for me, right, I think to touch on Derek's piece, we've been socialized to hate ourselves, right? Mm. You know, we've been socialized to hate everything that we like, to hate everything that we do, right? You know, so I think for me, when I was growing up, right, like, you know, being a tall, dark-skinned kid, right, you become a target, you know, like, ooh, with your black ass or whatever, right? Like, you know, so like, I think that, you know, because of the way society teaches us to view black folks, right, we are we're inherently taught to view that about ourselves. Mm-hmm. Right. So for me, one of the things that helped me to heal from that was understanding that, like, my circumstances and what I was going through was not by mistake but by design. Mm. Right. Like, it wasn't an accident, right, you know, why I was being treated a certain way. It wasn't an accident, right, that, you know, I'm the only person in my immediate family to have not been incarcerated, right? Like, it wasn't an accident, right, that, you know, my mother had passed due to medical malpractice, that, you know, my dad had passed, right, you know, before he turned 60, right? Like, you know, so it's like, it wasn't, these things aren't accidents, right? There are systems in place to make these things happen, right? And I think when I was younger, learning about that helped me to understand that, like, okay, so if there are people who are intentionally doing this, then what am I going to do to stop it? Mm-hmm. Right? And what am I going to do to uplift people who look like me so that way it doesn't continue to happen?
That's huge.
Right? So I think that's where for me, right? Like, I think that's where I began to heal, right? Like, because I began to heal by doing the work. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily saying that always doing the work is healthy, because it's not. Right. But like, I began to heal by understanding that, like, yo, I don't have to take these conditions. Right. I don't have to take what people are giving me and what people are telling me. Right. Like, it all started with a book. It was called Breaking the Chains of Psychological Slavery by a guy named Naeem Akbar. Mm-hmm. Changed my life. And I read that in high school. Then I read another book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. You know, to teach me about, like, the education system, right, and how the education system works. And reading those two together really sort of showed me, like, okay, this is not just, you know, my personal things. There is a structure that makes this happen. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, and after that, I changed my major, wanted to get involved in doing it, and I started doing the work. Right. And because of that, I've been able to, you know, better address things, not only in my own family, but my life. And then I was able to love who I am. Right. And I think if I combine that with hip hop, right, you know, because I think for me, hip hop and basketball were therapy, right? You know, so combining those things with, you know, my culture and things that helped to make me, helped to change my life, you know, so.
I think Dave definitely touched on it. I just want to say this real quick. A huge piece of this, and I want to make sure that this is thoroughly understood. It's not you, B. It's not you. Like, there are social determinants of your health that have nothing to do with you, that you did not create, but you exist in, that has caused the outcomes to be what they are. Mm-hmm. But when you come into that knowledge, when you come into the knowledge that the education system, the economic systems, the social and community context that you have around you, the health and the healthcare system that's built around you, the neighborhood and the built environment that you that is around you. You didn't create these things. You exist within them, right? But now that you know that knowledge, now that you have that knowledge, what are you going to do to change it for yourself and then change it for those you care about and change it for those in your community to transform those systems in order to make them more conducive to your own mental health?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? That's super huge. I'm so glad you said that, B.
Well, this is good. I don't want to keep talking. We'll have to wrap it up.
All right, cool.
Thank you both for sitting down with me. And, this was great. Thank you.
No problem. Shout out to ConnectedPod. Shout out to SJLI. Shout out to my man, Daniel P. Castillo. All these folks out here having a good time. Thank you very much, my man, Paul. This was a great subject, man. Thank you very much for having us on here.
Yeah. For sure.
Once again, I would like to thank Derek Steele and David Turner for sitting down and talking with me.
Something about it got me thinking harder about it. I saturated the thirst on my mind like if I planned it. They yet to understand it. Yeah, I've got these habits.
Legacy by Zeno.
I'm a part of society that values complacency rather than the awkwardness of a conversation that could save the lives of countless black people and possibly even my own. Imagine if your 12-year-old son was followed to school by a police car.
4555 1881, complainant says the unknown subject.
See, your perception has got me needing the prescription. I'm feeling like an outsider without a pot to piss in. Shackled in chains taken from our homes, forced to build a nation that never considered us one of its own. This media portrays thugs, drugs, and guns, ignorance, and just fatherless sons. All they show is Bloods and Crips, but forget to mention the crippled and bloodied slaves on the back of their ships, taking chunks of their soul whip by whip. We were finally free, or so we had thought. No more chains and whips, but then came the lynch mobs. Men in masks building crosses in front of your yards. Not as bad as slavery, but still unfathomably hard. School systems, bombing, segregation, and Jim Crow? I don't know what's worse, that or the police officers with the dogs and the fire hose. Years and years, that's how things had went. Until we found a messenger that was heaven sent. His name was Martin Luther King Jr. and he was a visionary. Totally extraordinary.
And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Our race has been vilified throughout the ages, portrayed negatively on a consistent basis. Let's face it. We have to take a stand before it is too late. We must show love when they show hate. We came from a people in chains, but now time has passed. How much has really changed? No longer beaten and chained. Now we open the whips and the chains, but the police shoot us daily and we still all seem the same. Caucasian viewpoints don't care if you're wearing red or blue. The only color they see is black, and they're looking at me and you.
Yeah.
This podcast was a collaboration between the Social Justice Learning Institute and ConnectedPod.
Images that go along with this story can be found at ConnectedPod.net.
This podcast was recorded at the Social Justice Learning Institute
in Inglewood, California.
Changing the Narrative was funded in part by a generous grant from the California Arts Council.
Learn more at www.artsca.gov.
Thank you.
And thank you guys so much for listening.
And to the listeners, remember, whatever you're going through, you're not alone. If you need help, seek help. There are a whole lot of people with their best interests in mind. So remember, having emotions does not make you weak.